There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. My guest today is John Wagner, the director of the Idaho National Laboratory. He's been a really busy guy recently because Idaho National Laboratory has been doing more for testing new reactors than they've done since they used to be called the National Reactor Testing Station. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rod. Really appreciate you having me.
Yeah, you've been a busy guy. You got elevated to director of the National Lab at an inflection point in nuclear energy in the United States. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on in the last few months.
Well, Rod, as you know well, it's been an absolutely incredible period of time. I mean, it's I find myself smiling a lot. I think I might have read somewhere on one of your posts about how you see me smiling, showing people around the laboratory. I've been doing a fair bit of that lately. And that's because of the great things that are happening. You know, as you kind of alluded to, prior to this summer, it had been more than 50 years since we started a brand new reactor on this site. And in the last about 2.5 months, we've done 3 of them, and we've done 5 as a nation. So really exciting times for a nuclear engineer to see us doing this again.
Yeah, it's the history of Idaho is really deep. You've been building a lot of facilities over the years. Some of those facilities have been reused recently in some of the programs like the reactor pilot program. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the real historical landmarks that are showing new life?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And as a laboratory, we kind of tend to do that, and not just at Idaho National Laboratory. I've worked at other laboratories as well. And as mission needs change, we try to utilize existing facilities for those. So in some cases, we find ourselves using older facilities for new purposes. And I'll explain one of those examples. And in other cases, just continuing to use facilities that were developed many decades ago in new and different ways, and in some cases, similar ways. So a great case in point is the EBR-2 reactor that was shut down in 1994. That containment dome was actually slated to be demolished. A few years ago, a group of us kind of realized that, hey, that was a valuable, useful structure that could be used for other purposes. Honestly, when we first started that conversation, we didn't necessarily have in mind that there was a need for a reactor testing or test bed, testing station, if you will. That kind of came on a little bit later. Then we've established that old containment dome structure as what we just call now dome. And as we talk today, Rod, the Radiant Kaleidos reactor is being moved into the dome like today. And so it's very exciting to see it repurposed now for brand new reactors. Other facilities, you might be aware, we recently had our Hot Fuels Examination Facility, or HFEF, designated an American Nuclear Society Historical Landmark. That's a facility that was first commissioned in the 70s, and now for more than 50 years has been our absolute workhorse for irradiated fuels and materials characterization. So a very large hot cell. So all the irradiated, essentially all the irradiated fuels and materials that we irradiate in our test reactors go through that hot fuels examination facility for all kinds of applications, whether that's TRISO fuel qualification, conversion to lower enriched fuels, so new fuels that are converting test reactors from high enriched to low enriched, to accident tolerant fuels, or you name it, that's our workhorse. So great examples of legacy facilities that are really, really active right now.
It's kind of interesting to me because the last guest on the last episode of the Atomic Show was Tori Shivanandan from Radiant. And yep. On that day that we talked, the Kaleidos reactor was being shipped from El Segundo. So now it's being installed in the dome.
Correct.
On the same day as the next Atomic Show. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
I don't know how he worked that out, but I like that. So now dome is a containment vessel. But I learned when I was out in Idaho that the EBR-2 or a lot of the equipment from EBR-2 is actually entombed in concrete and grout underneath that dome. Is that the case?
That is correct. So that, obviously the fuel and all of those kinds of things were removed, but the vessel is still down there, along with other structures that were grouted in place.
The word that I heard when I was out there was that the new reactors being tested there are being literally tested on top of the EBR-2. So that's probably kind of cool. I didn't realize that. So one of the things that you have to do as a laboratory director is hire people and attract them out to the high desert of Idaho. What kind of pitch do you have to new graduates, and have you been having any trouble recruiting new graduates? And then the next question is there are you seeing an increase in the number of applicants that you have for open positions?
Let me take those in a couple different ways. So let me sort of start from the end there. The fact that so much is happening in real physical nuclear systems again, Rod, you and I have seen the previous decades where we weren't starting up new reactors and the job field wasn't quite as exciting, frankly, is what we're experiencing right now. And so we are seeing a lot more people move into this field. So that helps on the sort of the people coming into the field side, but there's also a lot more opportunities. All these different private companies that we're working with are all staffing up as well, and so there's a very high demand for people, and not just nuclear engineers, but mechanical engineers, trades, operational folks. I mean, all across the many different disciplines that we need to operate nuclear facilities and build it, the nuclear facilities. In terms of like Idaho, it's actually an interesting story. I grew up in Missouri and spent a lot of time in Tennessee, and really had not spent much time in Idaho. I came to Idaho National Laboratory because I wanted to be a part of nuclear being built again, and it turns out this is an amazing place to live and to raise a family. And so while I've definitely encountered sort of reluctance, if you will, from people who had never been to Idaho, what I find is if we can get them out for an internship or a postdoc or some kind of visit and they see what's out here, most, not all, it's not for everybody, but most people really love it here.
I've always enjoyed visiting there, but it's a long way from anything. It takes forever to get there by plane.
I spent a lot of time on planes, Rod, and I honestly, that was my first experience. So when I was at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, I had a direct flight to Washington, D.C., where a lot of our federal agencies and sponsors are. And people would ask me when I moved to Idaho, what do you miss about Tennessee? And it was sort of half joking, but really not. I missed the direct flight to be in D.C. in an hour and a half. It's a little longer from Idaho, but I've certainly gotten used to it at this point.
Speaking of direct flights, I was interested to find out that there were direct flights from Dallas to Idaho. And I think there's a Texas connection going on there.
Well, there is. I don't think it's just related to that, but that is a nice connection for sure.
Now, of course, as lab director, you're still a scientist and have your PhD. Do you still get to do any research? Or are you doing mostly admin type work and meeting with the public?
So I do all kinds of things. I would not say that I do PhD level research personally anymore. But the beauty of my role is I get to interact with all the different researchers across many spectrums. Of course, I tend to talk about the nuclear energy part of the research and fuels and materials and artificial intelligence, and I get to interact in all of it. So it's a really great role. The type of research I find myself doing now is less what I would call the PhD level research, and more like literature reviews answering questions, and particularly policy related. You're probably aware that I've spent a lot of time investigating effects of radiation and radiation limits and how radiation protection limits impact nuclear facilities, cost, operations, et cetera. I find topics that are particularly interesting to me, and then I'm able to dive into those. One of them I dove into recently was the requirement that that we have in 10 CFR 46, part 46, sorry, related to a double ended guillotine break. So digging into things like that are typically more what I do, and really just engaging then in others and doing the the individual research in themselves and in teams.
I've been writing a lot over the years about the health effects of low-level radiation, and in my view, it's not just the fact that we anchor our regulatory construct in the idea that every dose of radiation carries harm. The problem I see is that we have taught not just the public, but the entire profession to be afraid of every dose, every single gamma ray. And that's just wrong to me. I mean, the research and the, if you're looking for evidence-based decision making, there is no evidence that levels below a certain level cause any harm. It just it I don't I've never understood that. And we are at a time where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is considering this, but they're starting from the basis of reasserting the idea that every dose is harmful. I just don't understand it. I don't know where the evidence is for that. And I guess they're open for comments from the public until August 31st, but I hope that there's an influx of comments coming.
Right. Rod, I could not agree with you more. And the data just simply does not justify health, any harm related to low doses of radiation. As you know well, I mean, I don't have to tell you, we live in natural background radiation. Natural background radiation levels where I live are much higher than what we set for public dose limits or even have oftentimes set for limits in facilities. And also, I would agree with something that you alluded to, and that is I think the fear of radiation actually causes far more harm in sort of typical situations than the radiation itself.
I've often told people that you'd have to really work hard to get me to evacuate for doses less than about 10 rem per month, maybe. It just, it's abandoning your home and your possessions and all that stuff is very health hazardous.
Yeah. And
There's.
there are documented cases of loss of life related to the evacuation of the Fukushima plant. I mean, those are real examples.
Yep. If you were king for a week, what changes would you implement in the way we approach nuclear science and engineering? Are there things that you would really like to see changed, or are we making progress in the right direction?
Actually, I'm going to tell you that I feel really good about the progress we've been making recently. You're probably familiar, and some of your listeners are familiar with the DOE order. So, in the DOE world, you can think about regulations as DOE orders. Last summer, the department significantly revised their DOE orders re regulating nuclear facility safety and security. And has since looked at other areas as well. These have made a tremendous benefit in terms of the cost and schedule for us to execute work while still doing it safely and securely. And so really removing kind of all the extra administrative bureaucracy, kind of control points and so forth, and letting work get done. For the last several decades, it's just been so difficult to get work done, long timelines, added costs, micromanagement at every step. And so I'm actually feeling really positive about this. And I'll give you just one concrete example. I could give you many. But in that process of authorizing a new facility, that could be a reactor, it could be a hot cell facility. When you went through the process in the past, just the last step, after you've got your documented safety analysis approved, so your paperwork is done, that last step was called readiness assessment. And over the last, several years, and we operate a lot of facilities, we operate four test reactors currently that we've been operating for a long time. To bring a new facility on, you might spend at least 6 months just doing readiness assessment after all your kind of licensing documentation is complete. With the revamps that they made, they have been completing readiness assessments in 3 weeks. So think about that, 6 months to 3 weeks. And what some people are surprised to hear is that puts much more of a square focus on the things that matter. And so I would argue not only are we as safe, I would argue that we're safer as a result of these changes that have been made.
One effect of that making changes has been the success of the reactor pilot program. I saw those readiness reviews taking place in that kind of accelerated and efficient manner and allowed us to get to the point where we started up four reactors in the space of, I think it was a total of 10 months. From start of the program, maybe even 9 months from the time when the reactor vendors responded to the RFP,
Right.
and then soon after that there was another one. So all of those reactors and startups and the readiness reviews were done much more efficiently, and it gave us a lot of tailwinds to move faster on the rest of the commercialization effort.
Absolutely. And by the way, I do want to give a special recognition to the Department of Energy's folks that do that nuclear facility safety authorization approval and then oversight, our DOE site office here in Idaho. Bob Boston and his team were absolutely essential to revamping those DOE orders that I mentioned, but then also working with each of these private companies on reviews of their safety analyses and then ultimately going through readiness, startup, all those things. It's been incredible to watch. And as you said, now we have significant tailwinds. Now three reactors have been started up here, one in Utah, one in Texas, and several more will follow this year.
I appreciate you giving the DOE field office credit, but there's been a lot of contributions made by your laboratory folks too. What kind of support were you able to give to some of these reactor vendors, and were you able to help those that were doing their work in Texas and Utah?
Yeah, so absolutely. I wanted to recognize the site office for their contributions. But yeah, we've had so many of our staff directly involved in each of these projects. And back to the reactor pilot program, one thing I want to make sure is clear is that that reactor pilot program was sort of a new construct in the sense that it wasn't federal dollars that were offered. In fact, all of these reactors were privately funded. What really was being offered is sort of a concierge service to enable these companies. And that service that these companies, needed varied depending on whether they needed a facility here, whether they wanted to build their own facility, whether they wanted to build a facility in another state. So as a laboratory, it sounds kind of strange, but we basically provided whatever they needed. And again, different companies needed different things. But what we did find is some commonalities. Typically they needed help from the department and or us related to the uranium they needed, related to the fuel that they needed. It may be related to security for that fuel until they were ready for it. A lot of the companies, hadn't operated nuclear facilities before. So they needed help in operation, what I'll call, conduct of operational type stuff. Might be quality program, RADCON program, crit safety program, training program, reactor operations, you name it. And so whatever the companies needed is where we tried to assist them. And we got very, very involved with most of the companies, whether they were here in town, or sorry, in Idaho, or elsewhere. It was really came down to what did they need, and that's what we tried to provide.
I'm curious about how you directed the resources, the people, to do that effort. Were you given any increases in your budget, or did you take people from other activities? How'd that work out?
I want to emphasize again, these were all privately funded. And so, it did mean if a person was, a lab employee was helping allo go critical, for example, that they weren't doing, whatever they were doing before. And so we did have some challenges. And frankly, I'm so proud of our staff. They rose to the occasion. I had people working long hours. I loved it when I had people coming to me saying, I've never worked so much and I've never been so happy, because they're working on meaningful things and seeing direct accomplishments occur. But they were all of the work on these reactors was supported by the reactor companies. And again, that might mean like preparation of a facility and re kind of refurbishment of a facility. For example, in the case of Antares Critical, Allo Atomics, their facility was outside of our fence, still on our site. They built their own facility, and so there was more support there in terms of the operational readiness and things like that. So it really quite varied a lot. We do as an industry need to grow more talent across this space so that we're not so that we're able to support this growth.
My response to people who talk about that is to remind them how quickly you can start building a workforce as long as you're ready to pay salaries and provide training and do meaningful work. Like you said, people tend to like to do productive work,
A
especially
100%.
some of the
You know,
hard-driven Americans that do this stuff.
we've talked about, how we're developing workforce for any area like that's in the future. Well, it's here now, and we're really seeing people respond to that. The other thing I'm really excited about is, I'm a traditional nuclear engineer. Went to school as a nuclear engineer. We're seeing people come from all sorts of other sectors into the nuclear space. People talk a lot about people coming from some of Elon's companies, whether that's SpaceX or Tesla. But we're seeing people come from all sectors: aerospace, defense contractors, car manufacturing, certainly various branches of the military. Which is, I mean, these are great skills that are being brought into the nuclear industry.
And not to forget, there's a lot of people from other parts of the energy industry coming, particularly oil and gas and some of the other growing parts of the energy industry, bringing their knowledge and specific development skills to nuclear, which is a
Absolutely.
wonderful thing.
Yep.
So INL is not just a nuclear laboratory. The N doesn't stand for nuclear, it stands for national. And what are some of the other areas where INL's got significant roles besides nuclear?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question because as a nuclear engineer and as, our primary mission space being nuclear, that is what I tend to talk the most about and is obviously a large area of focus right now. But I'm equally proud of the great work that we do in our national homeland security space and in our broader energy portfolios. And so where our focus is in national security is not like in nuclear weapons or anything like that that people might imagine. It's a strong focus in security of our critical infrastructure. Think about our grids, our power lines, our oil and gas distribution systems, and the cybersecurity of the control systems, as well as physical security of those systems that result in our grid resiliency, our reliability, our security of distributing, whether that's water, whether that's gas, whether that's electricity, really, really essential. So I've really enjoyed learning more about that part of the laboratory. And then broader energy, you probably are aware that we do work in a lot of energy areas. Particularly, we focused a lot on the integration of other energy generation with nuclear. As time has gone on, we're applying a lot of our chemistry and capabilities growing out of our nuclear sector and critical minerals processing. And then also, it turns out that we have a very large site. I'm sure you're aware of that, 890 square miles. We have a lot of heat under that site that looks quite interesting for geothermal energy. And so, a lot of different energy and national security applications sort of focused on energy and infrastructure.
So enhanced geothermal is one of the interest areas. I
Me
am
too.
fascinated by what companies like Fervo and
Yep.
whatnot are doing in that area.
I am too. And I've become a believer. I wasn't so sure. I went down and visited them, and I think they're really onto something.
There are some other tenants of the 890 square mile land that you have. What are some of the other tenants that you share the space with?
Yeah. So while we as running Idaho National Laboratory have responsibility for the entire 890 square miles, We have, you could think about them as kind of like islands on the site that are run by other contractors. Most notably, and of course, historically, has been the US Navy's nuclear reactor facilities. And what they do there primarily is receive and process the spent fuel out of the subs and carriers. And they've been doing that for a long time. They used to have prototypes out here as well. And I'll pause. I mean, I won't go too far into that, but really a great history there that Naval Reactors has had on our site. And then in addition, we have a DOE Inv Office of Environmental Management contractor called the Idaho Environmental Coalition, and they do cleanup work on the site. So processing of legacy waste materials, cleaning up D&D of old facilities and things like that. So those are the three primary contractors on the site: us, the cleanup project, and the naval reactors.
I think I heard a rumor that you guys do some work for the Army out there as well.
We do. That work is done by us, so so not a separate contractor for quite a long period of time. In fact, we celebrated 40 years last year. We've made armor for the U.S. Army's Abrams battle tank, so very, very proud. Another piece of our mission space that literally protects lives.
You've done a lot of stuff during your nuclear career. Obviously, you've been very successful, otherwise you wouldn't be a laboratory director. Can you name one or two of the things that you are really most proud of?
So I guess as I think about that question, I'd say, nobody really does anything on their own. Everything that I've been involved in has been a part of a team or teams doing great things. And there's a lot to be proud of in terms of the work that's gone on by these teams and by myself. I certainly look back fondly on my PhD research, hybrid radiation transport methods. I look back fondly on the team that when I worked at a company called Holtec that licensed, designed and licensed the HyStAR and HyStorm dry storage and transportation systems. But of course, the highlight is what the team has accomplished here at this laboratory. And that is, starting up these reactors over the summer and the many more that will follow, and what will ultimately transition to commercial deployment. I'm most proud of what this team has accomplished. Working across the department, private companies, and the laboratory over the course. And I need to note that that didn't just happen this summer. We've been building towards this. People have been preparing for it, whether that's preparing facilities, preparing their skills, preparing partnerships, that has now culminated in these reactor criticalities and much, much more to follow.
I often tell people, yeah, that's one of those overnight successes. Looking back into the idea of a music star who's been playing in honky tonks for the last 20 years and suddenly gets discovered, and
Right.
people forget just how much effort got put into that success.
Exactly.
Looking into the future, the reactor pilot program was a really interesting success, but it was sort of a one-off program that's going to have a follow-on, I guess, called the Nuclear Energy Launch Pad. And I believe I just saw a list of 13 projects that have been approved for the launch pad, some of which are going to be in Idaho, but the launch pad program has another component called Launch Pad USA. What are some of the projects? What are some of the things that you're going to see with this launch pad, and how does INL play into that program?
Yeah, and so you did just see that announcement yesterday, as a matter of fact. And so let me first kind of explain like what is the launch pad. And the reactor pilot program that you mentioned earlier was a direct result of the president's executive orders from May of last year. And that was fantastic for those that were selected, but many other companies have also ambitions or even follow-up ambitions. And so we needed some kind of construct for them to serve their needs. And so, in some ways, you could think about the Nuclear Energy Launch Pad as just a natural progression from the reactor pilot program into an enduring program, i.e., the Nuclear Energy Launch Pad. And it's also a broadening of that offering, if you will. So, the reactor pilot program was, as the name implies, focused on companies that wanted to demonstrate reactors. The launchpad is much broader. So it includes companies that are interested in fuel fabrication, companies that are interested in fuel enrichment, companies that are interested in recycling, companies that are interested in conversion, uranium conversion. And so this is going to be a program that companies can get help, for example, from the laboratory and DOE authorizations to enable that initial demonstration of those technologies, de-risk them on their path to commercialization. And as you mentioned, there's two tracks. You can come here to Idaho, and we have lots of land, and we have a lot of facilities and things that we can help. Or if you want to be in a different state, you want to be in Utah or Texas or where have you, you still have an opportunity and still have an opportunity to do so with our help, and with the help of DOE authorization.
It's a common topic in the financial world to talk about the valley of death, where you go from getting a demo and then trying to figure out how to get the financing to get to full commercialization. My view is that when you're talking about building machinery like reactor or nuclear power systems, there's a technical valley of death, because there's a big difference between a pilot reactor and one that's ready for selling to customers, ready for full commercial service. And particularly now, the customers for these small plants are not going to be like utilities that'll take something and kind of work out the kinks. They want a product that's ready to go. Will companies doing the stages between pilot and commercial have a spot in the reactor or the nuclear energy launch pad?
Yes. They have to be within the realm of the authorities of the Department of Energy for their, well, actually, they don't. Let me correct that. If they want to use DOE authorization, they have to be within the authorities of the Department of Energy. But if they want to do NRC licensing, that's also an option as well. So it really depends on what they want to do. We're watching these companies actually do quite successful at raising private dollars. Frankly, I see them more focused on being able to move fast than that is kind of a larger issue that they focus on than funding. There's been an awful lot of public announcements over the last couple of months of these companies being able to raise enough capital to move them through commercial demonstrations.
As people correctly say, time is money, and moving slowly and waiting for rather slow federal budgeting process is one of the things that's different now. People can raise private funding without waiting for, I guess it's almost a 2-year lead time to get something funded by federal appropriations, and that's just in some cases too darn slow, particularly as interest rates are no longer relatively close to zero.
Absolutely. And even if government appropriated dollars, once they're appropriated, they have a scope kind of around them. And so if you want to do something outside of that scope, that's not what those dollars are for. You have to go through a competitive awarding process that traditionally has taken quite a bit of time. So these companies being able to raise private dollars is really enabling them to move very fast. You partner that with our disposition, our bias for action, if you will. The Department of Energy's bias for action, you end up with results like, and I don't want, I don't have any favorite companies. We support all companies, but an example of like deployable energy, where from the time they approached us to the time they went critical was 155 days. And so nuclear, at least at the small scale, does not have to be slow. And as we move very fast with these smaller systems, we look at how do we scale that up to larger systems, and we absolutely can. I mean, there's going to be longer timelines around construction and so forth, but definitely lessons to be applied on the bigger systems as well.
I like to tell people that if you want to play in the NFL, you better start in Little League or Pop Warner League. It's
Exactly.
easier to move your way up rather than try to start building cathedrals before you even put together a tool shed.
Absolutely.
All right, John. I appreciate your time. I want to offer you the opportunity to summarize if you'd like to, or simply sign off.
Let me just say, for those who aren't familiar, something super special is happening in nuclear that we haven't seen in the last 30 plus years. The momentum is building. We have it working towards commercial deployment. That is our goal, and we're able to do this fast now. And I kind of said it before, but I'll sort of close with I've never seen government, the Department of Energy, private companies, and the laboratory working in aligned partnership like we are now. And this is just the beginning. This is the beginning of the new nuclear era for America.
What a way to finish it up. Thanks again, John.
Thank you, Rod. Appreciate you having me.
This is Rod Adams, host of The Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. I've been providing insights into atomic energy and advocating for better nuclear industry performance and accelerated growth since 1995. I hope you've had the chance to enjoy and learn from many of these posts and podcasts. But that's not all I'm doing. 6 years ago, I entered into a partnership that lets me invest into some of the most exciting young companies in the energy industry. With my partner, Valerie Gardner, we launched Nucleation Capital Fund One, a non-traditional venture fund to focus on investing into ventures that we believe are well positioned to flourish. Those companies will help us all reduce dangerous dependence on fossil fuels by using ever-increasing amounts of abundant, affordable, dependable, and clean nuclear energy. If you are an accredited investor, you can join us. What makes us non-traditional is that we allow regular people to invest in innovative private ventures in amounts from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We reduce costs and risk by building diversified portfolios using an online venture fund custodian. That custodian can help you determine if you qualify under SEC rules as an accredited investor and helps make our fund accessible and affordable. Investors subscribe at the level they can afford for the number of quarters they prefer, and we continue to see many exciting investment opportunities. If you believe in the long-term prospects of nuclear energy and want to put a portion of your patient investment dollars to work, please reach out, as every quarter we make 1 to 3 investments, but you have to be subscribed to get an allocation. Please visit our website, nucleationcapital.com, where you'll find a wealth of information. That's nucleationcapital, all one word, .com. If the content you find stimulates you to take the next step towards investing, please fill out an investor interest form.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.